Hello, everybody. And here we go again. That's nice. This is another system, actions, notifications. And he's got, so I've got no idea what's going on. Is this what people's lives are like? Like, if you guys use Windows, is this what it's like? Does it do this? Another one? No? Is this normal?
What? I think he was trying to set. It's not my fault. He was trying to set something up earlier. It's related to that. I am so sorry.
No. Okay, so here we are back again. Just waiting for the next exciting adventure. Does anybody feel like technology is just getting worse and worse? Yeah, generally, I think we kind of figured out how to do most of the things that are, you know, worthwhile doing. I don't know. I feel like if we were using the computers from 20 years ago, realistically, we could probably do basically everything that we actually need to do, right? I don't know, most of the time. Anyway, moving on. Colin and Benjamin. Oh my goodness, thank you so very much. Colin says Linux is better and free. Thank you. Benjamin says, I thank the computer gods every day for Linux. As do I, Benjamin, as do I. So Venerable Prasanna opines that Windows peaked at Win 95. Started to go downhill with, what was it, Windows 98 or whatever. Yeah. So if, in case anybody is afflicted by Windows, you can actually get free operating systems that work just fine and you don't have to use Windows. Okay. Where were we? Oh, yes. Please come in. No, don't be sorry. Be happy. Okay, so today, I have a quick question for you. Now, apparently there has been some promotion of this talk under the title Secrets of Meditation. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Has anyone said, did anyone come here because they thought they were going to learn the secrets of meditation? Okay. Did anybody do that? Okay, so I just want you to know that this is, in fact, a character profiling, and you have been determined that you are indeed susceptible to cult indoctrination. Because that's how cults work. Promise you some secret information. Welcome. Promise you some secret information. Anyway. So let us proceed with the chanting. And the chanting sheets are here. Anybody needs a chanting sheet, please. Anyone? No, we're all good? Okay.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sambuddhasa Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahaṁ sammāsambuddho vidhācāraṇa sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati sattha deva manusa Buddho Bhagavati Swakato Bhagavata Namo Sandirthiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatam Veditabho Vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Samichipatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Attapurisa pungala Esa bhagavato sahavaka sangho Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakirneyo, andarin karaniyo, anutaram punyaketang lokasati.
Okay, so well, Hasanta today mentioned we sometimes have a vote for the meditation. Who you would like to? Would you like to do that? Should we vote for the meditation?
Sure.
Yes? Yes. Or do you just want to be told what to do?
Otherwise.
any requests? Metta, Nilushi. Anyone else? Another vote for Metta. Metta in the lead. Anyone hates Metta? I had two people on my Norway retreat who hated Metta. As soon as I mentioned Metta, they were like, no, I hate this. And they told me. They're filled with anger as soon as they heard the idea of Metta. They recognized that it was an issue. You cannot predict. Really, you can't predict people's emotions or whatever. It's very strange. Okay, so let's do some metta meditation. Okay, so can anybody define metta for me. Anyone tell me what is metta? Loving kindness? Anyone else?
Friendliness?
One of the four immeasurables. Okay.
The greatest goal.
The greatest goal of Buddhism. That sounds like it's a huge thing to do. Do you think metta is a huge thing? Small and big at the same time. Okay, fair enough. Because you can see metta in just the smallest gestures, can't you? Amazing. And when you look at those, just those the tiny moments where someone shows an act of kindness, and like you see metta in animals all the time, you know, not just human beings, like the dogs have incredible metta. And so many animals in nature as well. And it's just such a normal, ordinary thing. So when I think the real genius of the Buddha and the other great sages who recognize the importance of it, it's not like when they're just talking about metta, it's not like they were discovering something new or even something that's particularly spiritual, really. It's not really anything. It's not spiritual in the sense. It's not something which is like separate and distinct, right? It's just an ordinary part of life, and we recognize that it is in fact that very ordinary part of life which is the most precious, the most amazing thing, which is incredible and transformative. That's really the insight, to be able to look at those small moments and realize, oh, that's something which is incredible. Like if we can take that and then grow it and evolve it, then it can change everything. Like seriously, how much of the world would be different if we prioritize keeping metta? Think about it. Think about like say, you know, during your day today, you know, whatever you've done, you've gone to work or you've looked at the internet or you've read the news or you've seen advertisements and you've talked to people and so on. How much of that was people reminding you and calling you to experience love and to practice it at a deeper level? I mean, it happens. It's not that it doesn't happen, but not enough, right? Only occasionally. And we find that a lot of the times people are calling for the other thing or even like manipulating and using it. So even if they talk about love or something like that, then often people can even manipulate that, especially in religious spheres, until what they're actually talking about is some kind of hatred and bigotry. And then they'll say it's because of Jesus's love or something like that. I'm sure Jesus would be very annoyed by that kind of thing. I honestly think if Jesus came back, he would go on a total temple-smashing rampage. Sorry?
Would I think the metta from Mark Zuckerberg?
The metta from?
Mark Zuckerberg.
If the Buddha came back, what would he think of metta from Mark Zuckerberg?
Meta.
Okay. But that's a different spelling, all right? I mean, that's M-E, that's one T, okay? That's one T. That's meta as in about. Yes. Well, I mean, Facebook was kind of like originally based on, well, I wouldn't exactly call it meta, but it was originally based on like rating the chicks in the college, right? So I wouldn't call that exactly meta. But anyway, okay. So what are we to do? We live in a world where there is so much hatred and there is so much conflict, and we live in a world where not only is there such a thing, but it feels like those things are amplified constantly. And look, we know that this is not just a theory or something like that. We know that on social media, it's well established that hatred drives clicks. And the people running the social media companies don't care about what is the emotional content or the information content of what they're doing. They only care about how many clicks they get. And they, the more hate there is, the more outrage, then the more clicks they'll get. And that's why those things are the way they are. So we need to do the opposite. Yeah, the Buddha said, be peaceful amongst those in conflict, be loving amongst those who hate. Yeah? Just because others are like that, it's not an excuse for us to be like that. And in fact, if we are to change things, then we have to start with ourselves. Right? We can't finish with ourselves, but we have to start with ourselves. And we have to be the ones who can say that we will not be responding with anger when anger is in the world. Not always easy to do. And as Dharma practitioners, we have to admit sometimes we're going to fail. Sometimes we're going to react. Sometimes there are things in us that trigger reactions that maybe have been there since we were kids, maybe even past lives. And then somehow it comes up and we didn't even think about it. Right? So to overcome that, we take the opportunity when we can to develop metta meditation. So what I'm going to do for now is just teach some basics of metta meditation. Did we do metta here last week? We did. We did metta here last week. So we did metta for oneself, right? I think so. So I'm getting confused because I've been doing metta on the Wednesday nights as well. So I'm not. My old brain is getting fuzzy. All right. So if we did metta here last week, we can do it for this week for the loved person. I don't think we did that last week. Is that correct? We did not do it last week. We did not. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to do basically the same method we did last week, and we're going to do metta for a loved person as well. And I'm going to say a few words about metta for the loved person to get us orientated before we begin the practice. All right. So So in the practice, begin with metta for ourselves. So everybody here, do you all know who yourself is?
Yes.
Yes.
There's no self.
Okay. Was that a trick question? Yes, probably. Probably it was a bit of a trick question. Okay, fine. So conventionally, we know who ourselves are, right? Okay, fine. Try doing that when the cop pulls you over and asks to see your license. I'm a Buddhist. We don't exist, so we can't be held responsible for the law. Did I ever tell you this? I don't know if I ever tell you the story about the girl I met who was grateful for Buddhists because they got her out of the mathematics exam. You know that story?
No.
I'm walking down the street in Fremantle, and so many of you have been to Fremantle. For those of you living in Sydney, I just want to explain a little concept for you. So in Fremantle, they have a concept called friendliness. I know, it's very strange. So what that means is that sometimes you, like, talk to people. Weird, isn't it, right? So I know people in Sydney will be not accustomed to this at all, but in Fremantle, you're walking down the street and somebody will say something and you say something back and you have, like, a friendly exchange like that. That's how that kind of goes down. Anyway, so I'm walking down the street and there's some kids at a coffee shop and say, oh, what are you, or what are you doing, or something like that. So I'm a Buddhist monk, and then one of them is this girl, a high schooler. She says, oh, I'm Buddhist. She said, oh, I really like Buddhism. They helped me get out of my maths exam. I'm like, I'm sorry, how does that work? She said, oh, well, we had this maths exam and I really didn't want to do it, so I told the teacher that I was a Buddhist and that Buddhists don't do maths. And they said, oh, okay. And they let me out of the exam. So there you go. Not sure if it's exactly write speech or anything like that, but the blessings of the Buddha manifest in unexpected ways. That's all I can say. Anyway, so where were we? Yes, friendliness. Oh, it's a love for ourselves, a loved one. Okay, so Venerable Prasanna says, out here in Campbelltown, I had three random friendly conversations in the street today. Of course, that would be Campbelltown. We were talking about Sydney. I'm sorry. But that's very nice. I'm glad that you could do that. I'm kind of exaggerating a bit about Sydney. It's also not, I don't think Sydney's an unfriendly place, actually. No. Anyway, moving on. So now we're going to do metta for a loved person, all right? So what we need to do for this practice, we need to think of that loved person before we start the meditation, right? You don't want to get into the meditation and then start thinking of it, because then your mind will get confused. So you need to do it beforehand. Now, you need to pick one loved person for your meditation. You can pick different loved people for different meditations, but only one for one meditation, okay? So, for example, if you pick your children, okay, this does not have to be like an existential crisis about which one do I love the most, all right? That's fine, all right? Okay, don't worry about it. Just do different ones in different meditations. It's fine, okay? And generally speaking, the idea is that the person for everyone's telling me about how much lovely conversations they have now in Sydney, so that's nice. one of the tricks to doing the metta meditation is that it's not the person necessarily that you love the most, but it's the person that you love the simplest. Okay, so we're looking for a simple, very pure love. Sometimes that means not the person that you're necessarily the closest to, because sometimes the people that you're closest to, you have a complicated relationship with, like, for example, your parents, right? You might have a complicated relationship with, or your partner or something like that. Whereas maybe, say, your grandparents, maybe you have a more simple relationship with, right? Or something like that. So whoever you love the most simply, all right? Don't choose somebody who you feel or you might feel sexual attraction to, right? We don't want to get mixed up, okay? And we don't want to choose somebody, well, when I was in Singapore one time, they asked me, they said in the youth group, they said sometimes the boys will do metta meditation for the girls and the girls will do metta meditation for the boys. Is that a wholesome way to do metta meditation? And I'm like, it's probably not the best way to do meditation, but it's probably not the worst way to do dating. So kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. Okay, so not someone you're going to feel sexually attracted to, not somebody who has passed away, all right? Because why? Because the grief will come or might come, right? Again, you want a simple, uncomplicated relationship. Even if you don't feel grief for that person, who knows, right? They might come and visit you in your meditation. And then that would be very upsetting. Or at the very least, interesting.
Good to clarify, because I was about to do that.
Okay, good, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, and to be clear, I'm only talking about in the meditation itself, okay? So it's got nothing to do with what you do outside the meditation. Do metta for anyone you like outside the meditation. It's not a problem. But in the meditation, think of it like a laboratory environment. We want to make everything as clean and as pure as possible, so that there's nothing which is going to be contaminating, nothing which is going to be biasing, nothing which is going to be complicating, okay? So we're setting up the most simple laboratory environment for being able to test this, okay? Of course, once you're fluent in doing it, once you know what you're doing, you can do what you like, right? This is just a way that we learn to train our mind to be able to to develop metta. Okay, so it's a way of assisting your mind. Generally speaking, metta for a loved person is fairly straightforward. Okay, some people find it easier than doing metta for themselves or whatever. It doesn't really matter too much. But the main thing is that when you develop these two stages, we're aiming to develop them so that they feel even. So that if you're doing metta for yourself and metta for a loved person, that they feel more or less the same. And so you're going to want to keep practicing again and again and again. Do metta for yourself, develop it as best as you can, and then go to metta for the loved one, develop that as best you can, and then see and check that these are similar. And keep doing that again and again and again until there's no difference between one and the other. Okay? All right. Okay, let's go. Let's do some meditation. So now sitting quietly. Letting your mind settle into your body. We begin by leaving our awareness in the heart and noticing the feelings, the emotions that are colouring our awareness at the moment. And keeping a sense of equanimity towards those feelings, whatever they are, accepting them,
Now, leaving the mind settled in the heart, say to yourself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, evenly and steadily. Keeping a clear and straightforward and steady intention. When your mind and purpose is firm, then it will sustain you through the meditation. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Connecting with that deep sense of longing. That fundamental wish that we all share to be happy. Don't worry about any doubts. Don't worry about any distractions. Just keep going. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Notice that along with those words of metta is also the feeling. Soft, gentle, beautiful feeling. Letting that feeling spread out through your whole body, soaking and saturating through every part of your body. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Now moving to metta for a loved person. We keep our mind exactly the same, not moving our mind at all, not changing anything, just the words of metta. So we put the name of that loved person into the words of metta. So if I choose my father, then may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever you've chosen for that loved one. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Not going over there to where that loved person is, not thinking about them, not trying to imagine them, not trying to remember them. Just keep going with the words and the feeling. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Keeping your mind with that beautiful, joyful feeling of love. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. And now coming near to the end of the meditation, from a loved one back to oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to come back to a neutral space, empty, open and clear. And in that empty space, take a minute to reflect back over the meditation, recalling what's just happened. How did you feel at the beginning of the meditation? We sat down and we spent a few minutes being mindful of our feelings. What were your feelings at that point? How did they change? How are they different now? What was the metta feeling like? Did you have any emotional responses or reactions to that practice? Did you feel that feeling of metta? If so, where did you feel it? What was it like? How long did it last for? What was helping it? What was opposing it? So this is a process we call pachavekana, or reviewing, which is useful to do at the end of every meditation. And if you do this every time, you will learn and your wisdom will grow and you'll understand how the process of meditation works. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And for today, I want to do a special dedication and sharing of merit with the people of Iran, and especially all of the innocent children who have been killed, women and other innocent civilians have been killed as part of that war. And war is always vile and always horrific, and in particular when there is no reason other than the aggrandizement of the egos of some psychopaths. So we don't know what the outcome of this war will be, and we don't know what the world will be like when it's finished, but we do know that the ones who will be suffering are the ones who didn't do anything to cause it. Okay, let's have a break, grab a cup of tea, and come back for the Dhamma talk. All right, so we're still getting friendly postings from the folks on the chats online who are like obviously just outraged by my little joke about the unfriendliness of Sydney. Anyway, fine. Fine. Okay, I admit it. Sydney's a friendly place and Campbelltown's a beautiful place, and it'd be great. And so is Potts Point and everywhere else. I mean, that's great. We do have some contention here in the audience, but I'm not going to entertain that. For anyone wishing, so Venerable Prasanna says, for anyone wishing to experience the friendliness of Campbelltown, Arms Round happens every Friday, 11 a.m. at the new library, or 11:30 a.m. at Mawson Park for a picnic shared meal. So Venerable Prasanna, very kind to keep that Pindabhata practice going. Excellent. While we're on the subject, we are doing Pindabhata in Burwood this week. So Venerable Prasanna will be there and I'll be there. So anybody who wants to come along to Burwood, about 11 o'clock, we can meet around Burwood Park, or you'll see us on the street around that time. Assuming it's not raining, we'll be having a picnic lunch in Burwood Park, so you can join us for the lunch as well. Usually a few people come along. It's nice. Come along and have a picnic lunch. If it's raining, then we usually go into the Westfield there and eat there. So if you want to chase us down, you'll find us in the Westfield if it's raining. And sutta discussion afterwards, right? Venerable Prasanna will be leading a sutta discussion on... on a sutta. that's incredible. That's incredible. Yeah. No, that's great. Okay, very good.
Okay. Majjhima Nikaya 21, the simile of the saw. Oh, well, it matches the metta theme. Excellent. So if you want to know how to use a saw, come along. I'm sure there'll be some practical. Will there be some practical demonstrations? Not like literal ones, because the sutta talks about sawing limbs off, so we're not going to do that. But anyway, moving along. Okay, so I'll try to stop being completely silly for a few minutes here. There will be a doctor on hand, so why not? Okay, fine. You know, this conversation could be quoted out of context and it would be very problematic. all right, so for this evening's talk, I thought I was going to say a few words about matter. So let me just explore that topic of matter from a Buddhist point of view. So in Buddhism, we talk, of course, a lot about mind, we talk a lot about meditation and so on, but the Buddha also talked about matter. So we know what matter is, right? It's this stuff, right? It's stuff that when you kick it, it kicks back, right? Nobody's willing to answer me. I've traumatized the audience here with so many trick questions over the years that nobody's willing to give me a straight answer to a straight question. Okay, it's not a trick question. Okay, so we know what matter is, more or less, right? Not a trick question. Next one might be, though. Okay, so I'm going to run down some of the Buddhist concept of matter and contrast it with how we think about matter and talk about it in modern times. Particularly, I'm going to contrast it with the default materialist conception of matter. Which is often kind of assumed in modern culture and certainly in secular culture. Okay, so let's just briefly have a look at what the Buddha was talking about and how the Buddha talked about matter. So first of all, the Buddha uses a number of different words and terminology to talk about matter. Let's break those down and see what they say and what they don't say. One word which is very commonly used is the word rupa, okay? Rupa, R-U-P-A. Rupa can mean matter or physicality generally. Often it means your body, okay? Often it means an image or a vision. And in fact, the roots of the word rupa seem to lie in the idea of a vision or an image. In fact, in the oldest meanings we get of rupa, it's often a manifestation of the gods. So the gods will display their rupa. And that sense sort of still persists in the way we talk about rupa. Like, for example, a Buddha statue is called a Buddha Rupa, right? It's the manifestation or the appearance or the form or the shape of the Buddha, okay? So we have this idea of the Rupa, the appearance of things, right? The shape of things, the form of things, and yet somehow meaning matter as well. Now, Rupa, we can analyze Rupa in different ways. First of all, we can analyze Rupa as being internal and external, okay? What does that mean? Internal is inside your own body, pertaining to yourself. External is the world out there. So this, I think, is one sort of layer of analysis which undercuts the idea that Buddhism or early Buddhism was an idealist philosophy. Okay, so if we're familiar with Western philosophy, you would know that the idea of idealism is that only the mind is real, and that the world of matter is an illusion, it's a fantasy. And there are some strands of Indian philosophy that tend towards that idea. Whether they are actually idealist is probably a bit of a subtle point and probably something that people have argued about and written long treatises about, and I won't attempt to solve it here. But certainly there's a tendency to see the world of matter, the external world, as being in some way not real, in some way an illusion. Yeah, and the Buddha didn't really do that. Okay, so for the Buddha, the external world was just as real as the internal world. So this is one detail that we can understand about matter. Another detail we can understand about rupa, the Buddha gave a series of similes talking about the five aggregates. So form is matter, rupa, feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. And each of them is given a metaphor. And the metaphors for like perception is like a mirage, consciousness is like a magic trick, and so on. Now, the perception, the simile for rupa is that rupa was like a mass of foam. Yeah. So this is a very specific, but the Buddha was very specific in the way that he chose his metaphors. So notice that a mass of foam isn't an illusion. It's not a trick. It's a real thing, right? But it has a number of characteristics. Number one, when they were talking about foam, of course, they're talking about the scum on the surface of rivers, right? So you're talking about something that is highly impermanent, right? And is being washed along by the stream. But also you're talking about something that is very spacious and structured, right? Something that looks from the distance like a solid mass and a solid clump, but in fact is largely empty, yeah? And that's the analogy that the Buddha gave of rupa. So again, it's not saying that rupa isn't real, but it does suggest that it's not exactly the way that we think it is. So that's another aspect of rupa that we can bear in mind. Another aspect which is very important for understanding Buddhism and which I think is largely neglected or largely misunderstood in the way that people analyze Buddhism, especially the role of matter in meditation, and that is through understanding the distinction between olarika rupa and sukkama rupa, okay, or olarika kaya and sukkama kaya. I should mention the word kaya here as well. So I've talked about rupa as meaning a form or matter generally. Kaya is a word usually meaning the body. Okay, so in Buddhism, the word kaya means the body. Interestingly enough, kaya is not really a technical term before Buddhism or in the Vedic traditions, but it is a technical term in the Jain tradition. So it seems to be adopted by the Buddhism, by the Buddhists, or at least shared with the Buddhists, part of a common vocabulary with the Jain or other Shramana traditions. Now, kaya, the root meaning of kaya means clump or mass. In fact, mass is probably the closest English word to it. So you can see that there's something similar to the idea of the foam there, like a clump of foam. Kaya is like a mass. Of course, the English word body also has a similar sense, right? You talk about a body of work or a corporate body or something like this. It's like a mass or a group of people. So this word kaya, which is similar to the word body in the sense of a conglomerate or aggregate or mass. Okay, so we have, I mentioned before, the olarika kaya or olarika rupa and sukkama kaya or sukkama rupa. Olarika meaning coarse or substantial, and sukkama meaning subtle or refined. And the sukkama rupa also called the manomaya kaya, the mind-made body. So this distinction is extremely important and very very central to an understanding of the way that the Buddha talked about matter, the way the Buddha talked about rupa and kaya in meditation, okay? And I see people making this mistake all the time because they only read these words in terms of their own materialist understanding of form and body and matter, and they assume that that's what must be meant when the Buddha's talking about meditation, and clearly it is not. Okay. So what is the distinction between these things? Well, the olarika kaya is, as the Buddha said, procreated by mother and father and built up out of rice and bread, okay? In other words, it is this physical body, okay? Or this normally what we mean when we talk about the body is the olarika kaya, and this or the coarse body or the substantial body. Now, that substantial body has a number of different characteristics. An obvious one being that it gets old and it dies and it passes away. Of course, in Buddhism, everything is impermanent, but the impermanence of the body is one of the most obvious manifestations of that. The Buddha's talking about old age and death, for example. He'll talk about the breaking of the teeth, the wrinkling of the skin, and the failing of the faculties and the other symptoms of what it's actually like to get old. Yeah. So this is the olarika kaya, and this is one of the dimensions of matter. The other dimension is the sukkhama kaya, or the subtle body. Now, sometimes this is, and so the sukkhama kaya is essentially the energetic body that you perceive from the inside, all right? It is the physical perception or understanding or awareness of what your body is doing. So to understand it simply, you just think of cases like where, say, somebody has a limb amputated, right? And so when they have their limb amputated, then maybe they feel like there's a ghost limb. They still feel like the limb is there. And so in that case, their olarika kaya has changed, but the sukkhama kaya has not adapted to it. So there's a mismatch between the olarika kaya, the physical body, and the sukkhama kaya, or the perceptual body. Now, that sukkhama kaya, is that real? Right? So this is the kind of question which a materialist would ask. A materialist would ask, is that real? Can I measure it? Right? Can I get in a laboratory and do a test and be able to find it and make it on my little screen and write an article about it and get it published and say, yay, I've discovered sukkhama kaya? I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But that's not really what the Buddha was talking about. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of studies and so on that you can talk about that seem to maybe suggest that you can, in fact, measure something like the sukkhama kaya. And if we wanted to talk about people's different experiences and so on, then you could do that. But that's not mostly what the Buddha was talking about. What he's talking about is not whether somebody else can measure it. It's whether you can experience it from the inside. And this is really the key difference in the way that the Buddha talked about matter in his philosophy compared to Western philosophy. Western philosophy, matter is mostly what somebody else can see from the outside, whereas in Buddhism, it's mostly what you see from the inside. It's your subjective perception of matter. So when we say it's your subjective perception of matter, what are you actually perceiving? Well, you're not perceiving things as such. What you're perceiving is qualities or properties. So when we talk about perceiving matter, what we're really saying is we felt heat, let us say, or we saw color, or we felt like an impact or a pressure. And so these are things which are qualities or properties, and we then interpret those as being reference to an external world. Right? So this is that internal perception of matter. Now, once we understand this, then we can start to make sense of the way that the Buddha talked about matter in meditation. For example, in the jhanas, so the Buddha talked about various stages of advanced meditation called the jhanas. We have the four jhanas, taught very often throughout the suttas, hundreds of times. And we also find the four arupa attainments, often called arupa jhanas. And the first four are sometimes called the rupa jhanas, the form jhanas. And the other ones are the arupa jhanas, the formless jhanas. So what does that mean? What does it mean to call a state of meditation a form meditation or a material meditation, a physical meditation? Seems like an odd choice of term to use to describe that, okay? So when the word rupa is being used in meditation like this, it doesn't refer to the physical body, it doesn't refer to the material world, it refers to that sukkhama kaya that we were talking about before. And in particular, it refers to the perception of certain physical properties, namely light. Okay? Light is a physical property. Yeah? Even if you're perceiving a light inside yourself, it's a perception of light, and that counts as rupa. And this, again, is something which I think most people don't really understand when you're reading the suttas. If I have a light outside in the room, this is a rupa. It's a physical reality experienced externally, bahidda, outside the body. If I imagine a light in my mind, this also is rupa. It doesn't correspond with any particular physical light, but it has the same property. That's what matters. It's the subjective perception of that property of light. That is what makes it a rupa. So we can experience rupa not just through sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, but also just in the mind. So when we're meditating, meditate, 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 the outside world starts to go away. The olarika kaya starts to fade, and we start to perceive the sukhama kaya, which has a more subtle mode of perception to it. And we start to see that manifesting as light. Yeah. And this, of course, sometimes we call the light a nimitta, but in the suttas, we don't call it nimitta. In the suttas, they just call it that rupa, or they call it a light, a bhasara or obhasa or pariyodata. There's many terms for referring to this kind of experience of light in meditation. So this is what it means when it talks about the rupa jhanas, right? That the rupa jhanas, and some ways based on or associated with this experience of the sukhamakaya, especially manifesting as the light which we see in meditation. So these are like the echoes or reflections of those external physical properties, but they are experienced and perceived entirely from inside oneself. And in the arupa jhanas, of course, even those things, very subtle though they may be, are falling away and they're no longer present. So this is a very kind of brief survey of some of the aspects of matter in Buddhism and Buddhist meditation. I want to quickly contrast that with, I'm tempted to use the word Western, but it's really much more widespread than that these days, but a materialist or a secularist approach to matter. So there, of course, are many aspects of the Buddhist analysis of matter that are very similar to what we consider from a modern scientific analysis. For example, the Buddha analyzed matter into the four elements or four great properties, earth, water, fire, and air, which correspond with the physical properties of solidity, liquidity, gaseousness, and the last one, the fire element, corresponds with plasma. Okay, so thanks to Madhu. I'm not sure if Madhu's here today, but if Madhu's online, thanks to Madhu. It's a friend of mine from Sri Lanka who's a plasma scientist, and she explained to me what plasma was, so that's how I figured that one out. So thanks for that, Madhu. So plasma, and so this corresponds pretty well to that understanding of what are the major states of matter, right, that we in Pali would call like the Mahabhuta, which we could call the primary states. Like Mahabhuta literally means the primary states of matter. Okay, fine. So in some ways we have that similarity and that crossover, but then in other ways, of course, it's quite different as well. So from a Western point of view, all right, our scientific point of view, We have evolved through science ways of looking at matter, ways of thinking about matter, theorizing, and also operating on matter that have proven to be very successful. And we can analyze through, especially starting with Newton and Newton's incredible breakthrough in understanding like how the physical world works. Finally, we had all of these formulas and all of these understandings that enabled us to see like the relationship between force and mass and velocity and acceleration and all of these things in ways that were so incredibly precise. And that, of course, then led to the success of Newton is not just that it was clever. Lots of people have clever ideas. The success of Newton is you can then go out and build a steam engine, and then you can put that steam engine on a train, and you can put it on a ship, And you can build an industrialized society based on our ability to understand physics. And we can build aeroplanes, and we can build laptops and mobiles. And we can actually implement these things. This is why the Western theories of physics and matter are so successful. It's not just that they are theoretically attractive or beautiful or parsimonious or anything like that. It is that they are effective, that they work. In other words, in my view, the real reason why physics is successful is not because of the physicists, sorry, Mike, but because of the engineers, right? Because the engineers take the insights of the physics and actually make them work. If not, it would be another interesting field of inquiry, but because we actually build them, then that's what has transformed the world. That's what's created the world that we live in today. Now this, okay, so this obviously is incredible. And like we live in this world, and I think we forget like how much, we just take it for granted how much the world has been transformed. And we forget things like how magnificent, okay, engineering is. Shout out to all the engineers here today. Any engineers in the room? Any civil engineers, structural engineers, mechanical engineers? No engineers here. Oh, we have an engineer. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We have an engineer here today. And it's incredible, right? Honestly, it's incredible. We live in a, we walk into a building and it doesn't fall down. Thank you, all those engineers, right? You get in a car and it like drives from one place to the other. You don't even think about it. The engineering that goes into these things is incredible. And so our ability to manipulate matter and to turn it into something which will serve us is astonishing. It's incredible. But it also comes with a cost, of course, because we kind of forget that, well, these things don't just exist to serve us. That matter is not something that merely lives out there objectively in the world that we can operate on. And so the very success of that scientific paradigm also leads us to forget that there is wisdom that came before and beneath and beyond the wisdom that science can give us. Long before the time of the Buddha, we also had ideas about matter. And I mentioned before about the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And I said these are somewhat similar to the Western concepts of these things or scientific concepts of these things, which they are. But they are also gods. And that's something that we also forget most of the time, that these things are gods. The earth is a divinity. The sky is a divinity. The sun is a divinity. Fire is a divinity. The rivers are goddesses. The oceans are goddesses. These things are always full of divinity. What does it mean for something to be full of divinity? Does that mean that there is literally a god who's living in the sun, who's driving his chariot across the sky? I don't know. We can look through our telescopes and look at the sun, and we haven't found a chariot yet, right? And so we have this idea, scientific idea of sun, that is incredible. Like the way that we can look at the sun today and look at the solar flares and the solar activity and all the, what are the kind of radiation, it's incredible. And we can look at it in so much detail. I mean, the sun has weather patterns and moods and changes, which we can observe in detail. But we haven't found any chariots so far. So, of course, the way that people were thinking about these things was in terms of metaphors and so on that they could understand, right, to make sense of these things. But the idea is that there is something sacred in all of these things. There's something sacred in the earth. There is something sacred in the water. There is something sacred in the trees. There's something precious, something valuable. There's something that has a power and a meaning that is beyond just us. A tree doesn't just exist. A tree is not just pre-timber. It's not just a resource that exists for us to chop it down. A forest is an incredible thing. It is, a forest is thousands of years of organic intelligence, of fungal networks, of root systems, of bees and bugs and birds growing and living and thriving and changing in all different kinds of ways. It's complex beyond belief. And it's irreplaceable. It contains within it like a history of weather and climate and action and activity that can never be reproduced. And yet we think of it as being a resource that we can utilize and we can extract and we can make profit out of and turn it into something that we like, because we don't like, but like we think we like trees and forests, but here we are in this room made of carpet from fossil fuels, painted with paint on the walls made from fossil fuels, made out of concrete, which comes from taking a mountain, smashing it into pieces, grinding it into paste, cooking it at a couple of thousand degrees, and then turning it into something which has nice straight lines, which we like because it's clean and nice and neat and we can control it. So the reality is that if we're to be honest, we like nature when it has been smashed up, pulverized and turned into a paste and converted into something that is amenable for our use. Sad to say. And we have this romantic idea that we love forests. And we love the meaning in forests. And I believe that we do. Like, I don't think we're being hypocrites, but I think we struggle to fully appreciate the depth and the magnificence of nature and the depth and the magnificence of that which we are losing every day. And right as we're sitting here, as I'm giving this talk, nature is disappearing. And at an astonishing scale, we are assaulting nature in a way that is unprecedented. We are taking what we want. We are not considering what the earth wants. We're not considering what the earth's limits are, and we're not considering what our role is within this. We assume that our role is something which is above and beyond this. And as someone who has a sort of a philosophical tendency, you know, I can't help but relate this to this materialist philosophy, this idea that somehow all there is matter, and matter itself doesn't have any particular meaning or particular value. And so from this materialist perspective, consciousness is something which emerges from matter. So if we get matter, we arrange it in a certain way, then consciousness pops out on top. I mean, I could discuss this theory at some length, but I think this is a highly incoherent theory. And certainly I can say that it's not, like, from a philosophical point of view, it's certainly not particularly, like, when I was studying philosophy, this was regarded as being a very primitive theory of consciousness. And it wasn't something that was regarded as being, oh, yeah, this is obviously what science has shown us, right? It's an assumption that people make. But from a philosophical point of view, and certainly from a Buddhist point of view, it's not what the world is. It's not how things work. So consciousness from a Buddhist point of view is not something which emerges from matter. Consciousness is something which is primary. The primary reality, the reality that we experience, is the network. It's the system. It's the interrelationship. And when we experience that system, we experience physicality, we experience light, we experience these physical properties, we also experience mental properties, consciousness, awareness, perception, feeling, thought. And these things are always in relationship with each other. The primary reality is that interrelationship. Just as if you go into nature, the primary reality is the forest. And then from that forest, yes, we can analyze and we can say, oh, this is a tree, this is a weed, this is a flower, and we can analyze them out separately. But any biologist would tell you that our ability to separate species is highly limited, because all of these species are completely interdependent all the time. And so this is really just a convention. So in Buddhism, it's the same thing. The reality is this organic mess, this network, this connectivity, this relationship. And matter and mind are things which we infer from that, which we abstract from it. They are secondary inferences. So that means, among other things, it means that the world of matter is somehow imbued with consciousness or somehow imbued with value and meaning in a way that is not just lumpen stuff, that our existence in relationship with matter has something sacred to it, and that sacred thing we can call God. We can look at it from a religious point of view and talk about it in that way, but we don't have to. We can just feel that. We can feel that connection and feel that sacred sense of meaning in where we are in the middle of nature. So this is a few words for you today on the Buddhist idea of matter in meditation, clarifying a few terms and looking at some of the philosophical implications. So Benjamin gives us a very nice quote here from Wendell Berry. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
What were those two bodies again?
The Sukhumakaya, or the refined body, and the Olarikakaya, the coarse body. Yeah.
Okay, so Sukhuma body.
Okay. Sukhuma, yeah.
When we go with a meditation and you have the sensation in your chest of that.
Yes. Yes.
So that's called Sukhuma?
That's correct, yeah.
So can I ask whether, so it's always internally, not externally?
No, Sukhumakaya can also be external.
So does my mind go straight to physics?
Okay.
And like the mass of the, like a spike, like Earth, or maybe the sun will have
the
spy around it will kind of bend. We don't see it, but
okay.
Einstein says it will bend and it has kind of a mess.
Space time is curved, yeah.
Yeah, it's curved. So that spy, that you know, the thing that we can see.
Okay.
Is that Sukhuma as well? Can it be used called Sukhuma?
I'm not entirely sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, right, right.
And so I would just connect.
Yeah, so the connection between, so the first thing that Sumana asked is about whether the body, the experience in metta meditation is the Sukhumakaya. Yes, that's correct. And that's also what happens when you're doing breath meditation. So when you do breath meditation, you start out by being aware of the coarse body, which is the feeling of air. And as time goes on, you see more and more the Sukhumakaya, which is the light or the bliss and the perception within that. So the Sukhumakaya is always there. It's always a dimension of that, but it tends to get overlaid by the Olarikakaya, which is more, has stronger sensations. So, but then so that one's pretty straightforward. Then the next question you're asking is about, I think, space. Space itself is, like, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that one, so I'm probably going to just mumble a little bit and hopefully move on to the next question. Maybe we can talk about it in more detail later, okay? But I didn't talk about space, but space in Buddhism is, space itself is part of Olarikakaya, so it's something which is inferred from the other elements, okay? It's like a relationship between those other elements. It's not something that necessarily exists, but something which is the absence of the others or the space between them. Yeah. Yeah. But as far as, yeah, we would have to talk about that. We will talk about that in more detail sometimes. Yeah. Yes. Kat. Sorry, Shanti.
I don't know how to pronounce that.
Olarika? Olarika Kaya.
Is something you get from your parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't meditate.
What do you mean you can't meditate on it?
So, like Sukhumakaya, you can now meditate, you can feel it from within, coming from within.
Yeah.
But the first one is, yes, you don't meditate on that kind of thing.
Why not?
That's something that has come from your parents.
No, no, no. It's just your body as you're sitting there.
Yeah, the body.
Yeah? Yeah, sure, you can meditate on it.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Like if you're doing breath meditation, you meditate on the feeling of air which is coming in and out, right? If you're doing, say, mindfulness of your postures, you're just, where are your feet? Yeah, and so on. Yeah. In fact, all meditation is initially grounded on your Olarika Kaya, on your coarse body, yeah, basically. Yeah. Or say, elements meditation the same. Or the parts of the body. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's where you begin. Not where you end up, though. Yeah? Kat?
Does, when you were talking about the body, does it map to is the nine body system of like emotional body, etheric body, astral body? Is it sort of related to that that you're talking about?
So when I'm talking about the body, does it map onto the nine body system? Nine bodies sounds like a lot of bodies. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know about that system, so I couldn't really say. Yeah, but there are similarities with the way the Buddha talked about it and the way that you find in like the Brahmanical texts and Vedic texts. They're not exactly the same, but there are some similarities. Yeah, I'm not familiar with those nine bodies. Yeah, but it's look quite likely. You know, quite likely there's some similarity, yeah. So a couple of people are starting to leave, so we're approaching the end of time, so we should probably wrap up. Okay. Just one brief question. So Tim asks about the what use of the word kaya in the third jhana. Yeah, so there the kaya is the sukkama kaya. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for joining with me today. Congratulations on surviving another week. It's incredible. Seriously. And especially those of you who use Windows operating system. Like, honestly, my heart goes out to you. So much respect. I mean, I still remember like being at Bodhnyana and we'd get to the office in the morning and I'd sit down and start doing my work and all the monks who were using Windows would sit down and start debugging and checking their antivirus and all of those things. I'm like, oh, my goodness. It's amazing how people manage to do any work with that. By the way, Dira Yupa mentioned that she has no choice than to use Windows in her industry. You can double boot, by the way, Dira Yupa, so you can dual boot Ubuntu and Windows, or put it on a separate machine. You just dual boot and then use Windows for whatever you need to do for your work, and then you can use Ubuntu or some other Linux distribution for everything else. Yay. Okay. So I will stop talking about Linux for now. Mac and Ubuntu dual boots as well. Good to know. Okay, so we'll be back next week, 7 o'clock here at Crow's Nest. Tuesdays, 6 o'clock at the 5 at the library in Parramatta. And this Sunday at Burwood for the Pindabata and the picnic, if you would like to join us for that. I think they're the main events coming up. And I believe Venerable Prasanna is doing the Sutta class on the Sunday after the picnic. And Venerable Prasanna, I believe, is also doing the Wednesday for the Metta Centre in Parramatta. That's at the Western Sydney Uni in Parramatta Square. Is that correct, Venerable? Yeah? So am I going to see you then? Maybe. We'll be in touch, okay? But if you want to come, you know, grab a coffee or something like that before the talk or whatever, we can do that. Okay. That's it? Is that it? Okay. May you be happy. See you next week.